sort of reinforces certain types of behaviours. You're going to get people who are good at that, who are good at empire building, for example. We've all seen it in an organisation. Oh, you know, person X has just inherited another department building their empire. You know, we all know those people, and they may or may not be the best people to run a department of 500 staff. They may not be great at people management or whatever, but they're good at something else. They're good at some sort of political manoeuvring that gains them that power. And I think that's the trick to me about this sort of question of, you know, incompetent men getting ahead, or incompetence basically getting ahead, is we judge the wrong qualities when we look at those types of roles. So, you know, do you want an organisation to be run by people who are really politically astute at grabbing power?
That's Nancy Roberts, up next on the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I am your host. This is where we go long form on risk and uncertainty across some of the most relevant, interesting, and fun topics on this planet. And before we get into our latest episode, I know that the frequency of our episodes has dropped a little bit. We're going one every 3 weeks at the moment, and that's set to continue for a few more episodes, but there's an exciting reason for that. We are in the process of launching an online course on decision making. It's called How to Make Impossible Decisions with Calm and Confidence. It's still in progress, and we'll keep you up to date on that. And I'm very excited about it. We've had loads of really interesting and insightful conversations on this podcast, as well as a number of lessons on decision making that I'm pulling together in the form of a course. And I'm also adding loads of stuff to that into a course that has got 7 modules. You'll be hearing a lot more about that. And here's a secret. I have already soft launched one of the 7 modules, which you can access for free. Just go to all-things-risk.teachable.com. That link is also in the show notes. Please check that out and let me know what you think. The full course will be coming over the next few weeks, so please stay tuned for that. All right, today we talk about diversity, inclusion, and equality, particularly in the workplace. And it's one of these topics that is important, but strangely polarizing, or perhaps not so strangely polarizing. The Jordan Peterson, Kathy Newman interview of a few months back is perhaps a good case in point on that, and a good case in point that our insights aren't really based on data, at least not in the popular discourse. And well, that's kind of crazy because it's 2019 and data is everywhere, for God's sake. Data is the new oil. And we also know that in organizations, diversity, particularly at the top, diversity of opinions especially, is a crucial way to manage risks. And the 2008 global financial crisis perhaps would not have happened, or perhaps would not have been as severe, if there was more diversity across the boards of big banks, for example. We should be using the data that we have to try to answer some tough questions on diversity and to ask whether or not our large organizations and institutions are reflective of our societies, and whether or not that's a good or a bad thing. And in doing so, our organizations can not only better manage risks, but perhaps systemically we'd be able to manage a whole range of uncertainties. And well, that's exactly what my guest on today's episode has set out to do. I want you to meet Nancy Roberts. Nancy is the founder of Umbrella Analytics. Umbrella uses artificial intelligence to deliver diversity, to improve the diversity of an organization's workforce. And we get into all of that. Nancy is amazing. She has a background in publishing. She has, for many years, as you'll hear, has had a passion for equality, more broadly than just equality in the workplace. But after many years of directly witnessing inequality and the slow, very incremental pace of change, she decided to do something about that. And that's how and why she founded Umbrella. She is an incredible entrepreneur, and the work that Nancy is doing is very important because at all levels, if our big companies and institutions don't reflect the composition of our society, be that on gender, ethnicity, or any other factor. And if they don't reflect diversity of opinions and perspectives at the very top, they will underperform, and our societies could be in a whole host of trouble. But to really address that stuff requires data, not diatribes or myths and legends. And that's what makes Nancy's work so relevant. And we talk about all of that. We get into the data on inequality, differences between men and women in the workplace. And if you're a man, please do listen to this section in particular, because there are some insights that Nancy is able to bring that you perhaps haven't thought about and considered. We talk about organizational culture, why people go native in big organizations, quantifying culture, how organizations can alter the language that they use in communications and things like job descriptions to get better candidates, and just tons more. So let's get into it. Here is Nancy Roberts. To the All Things Risk podcast. This is going to be a lot of fun, and it's a pleasure to have a peer from our startup course days. So welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here and exciting to catch up with another startup escapee.
Yeah. So before we talk about diversity and inclusion, I wanted, for my listeners who don't know who you are, mm-hmm. and when you get asked that terrible question, what is it that you do? How do you respond?
So I would say that I was put on the earth to kind of make the workplace more equitable in whatever way, whatever form that takes. So I'm passionate about the kind of systemic problems that people face at work, either through gender, race, class, you know, whatever it might mm-hmm. be, that sense that you have to fit into an organization and conform to their way of doing things, even when that's, you know, sort of morally wrong or doesn't suit the way that you work or doesn't suit who you are. So I'm really interested in tackling that at a kind of systemic level. So mm-hmm. looking at an organization, looking at the way that they run their business, run their culture, and trying to figure out what consequences that has for people and how we can help overcome those consequences.
Cool. And is that something that you, I guess, is something that you fell into?
Yes.
or was it something that, well, tell us a little bit about the journey to getting to that place where you realized that this is the type of thing that you did. Did you always want to do this type of thing, or?
I guess it's always been a passion. It's never really seemed like a career before. So when I think back, like, I've always been quite incensed by some of the like illogical things that go on in the name of kind of culture and are just accepted as the way things have always been or the way we do things. And that's always kind of bugged me. So going right back to my school, you know, I was at a mixed boarding and day school. And the boarding house, which I was in, was mixed as well. There were a lot of guys in my year, not very many girls. And we just got treated differently. Like, they had activities at the weekend organized from the age of about 12. So they would, you know, go off and watch football, or they'd go ice skating, or they'd go to the cinema or whatever. And they had someone paid to come in and do that. But it wasn't really open to girls unless the boys didn't want to go, which was kind of like, well, why does that make sense? Why do we have to stay in and they get to go out and do stuff? And there were lots of examples like that. Like, we had an earlier curfew than them. They had different rules, different, you know, places that they could go and stuff like that. And it just didn't seem to make much sense to me. And some of the consequences of it were just bizarre. So, like, if we went to the pub, they would all be able to stay out later, which meant, like, you got two 17-year-old girls, well, 18, I should say. Obviously, we were not drinking at 17. But we'd be walking home on our own, and half an hour later, there'd be, like, 20 guys walking home. It's like, well, wouldn't it make sense if we all stuck together, like, for safety reasons? It just didn't seem logical to have these rules in place, and it seemed like the consequences hadn't really been thought through. And I guess, like, I at school certainly protested a lot about that kind of thing. And that sort of carried on, I guess. I just can always see these things in organisations, in universities, wherever I've been in my life, my professional life. You can see these injustices, and they just don't make sense. And it kind of burns me up. And I guess for a long time, I sort of internalize that as like, maybe I'm the one that's wrong and the system seems to make sense to everyone else. So I kind of went along with that for a long time. Like, I should change. I should stop, you know, protesting about these things. I should accept certain, you know, certain things in my professional life, certain behaviors. And then I guess, I don't know if it's age or experience or just your mindset changes over time. I've just sort of thought, no, this is not right. You know, we shouldn't accept this kind of treatment. So, you know, for example, the kind of casual sexism that's very, very common, particularly, you know, happened to me a lot in publishing. You know, you'd sit there, have a 2-hour business meeting, negotiate a contract, and at the end someone would go, well, you're very attractive to be a production director or something like that. And you're like, is that really what you've been thinking about for the past 2 hours? Because I've been thinking about the contract. And, you know, you sort of accept that because it's fairly common. But increasingly, I just think, why do we accept that? And what are not only the personal consequences, but the consequences for organisations and actually for society in terms of just letting that stuff go? So increasingly, I feel like we have to tackle these things. We have to foreground why they're happening and what the issues that they are. That they cause, like, for organizations, for individuals, for society as a whole. It just doesn't work anymore, I don't think.
So you had a trajectory, career trajectory in publishing for the most part.
Yeah, so I was first generation in my family to go to university, was lucky enough to get a grant and, you know, be able to afford to go, which otherwise I would not have been able to do. So I did that, and I went into publishing really without knowing much about it because from a working class background, it wasn't really, you know, a profession that we knew anything about. And I went into it and it was good fun. And I, you know, I had a laugh and I like books and I like people who think. So there was a lot of good in it. But it is a very elitist industry. It's very white. It's very well educated. It's quite sort of snobbish in many ways, academically snobbish, intellectually snobbish. And I sort of felt like, you know, you have a responsibility in publishing because you're controlling what people are reading. I mean, that's changed now with Amazon and things, but at the time, you know, there was only really one way to to get published, and that was through a publisher. And if you've got a very homogenous group of people making those decisions, then they're kind of defining the culture. And I was studying part-time because I always loved academic study. So I did a master's and then a PhD part-time. And I thought about going into academia, but that has many of the same issues, and it didn't feel to me like it was really different enough. So I kind of stayed in publishing because it was fun and, you know, people were nice on the whole, and I learned a lot. But I then just reached the point of, you know, I'd got to the top of my particular function. I was in a really good job, couldn't see where I wanted to go next, and just thought, I don't want to do this for the next 20, 25, however many years. I want to do something meaningful. And then, yeah, I guess I just sort of tried to figure out what that would be and arrived at a kind of a data-driven view of these cultural issues, I suppose, which seemed to me particularly interesting and not something that many people were talking about. People talk about organisational culture a lot, but it tends to be much more softer, much more sort of psychology and behavioural traits and things like that. And I thought, well, there's actually a hell of a lot of data here about how, for example, women can't get into leadership positions or are less likely to, and if they do, they're less likely to be paid the same. And, you know, all of these things are not just one individual, they're kind of systemic. So I was interested to sort of dig into that and say, what's going on in these businesses where this happens?
Yeah, let's talk about some of these things a little bit more. Maybe, it might be interesting to just talk a bit about, so as a male in the, having spent most of my time professionally in the corporate space, I think I'm probably not oblivious, but quite blind to what the experience might be for a female to be spending time in a corporate environment. And when you said the thing, you know, just that story, you know, end of the, you know, 2-hour contract review, and someone says, "Oh, you're quite attractive," that's certainly not come up for me. Which is good. But it just also speaks to an experience that is entirely different than one that I would have had. And I probably walk around the many, or have walked around the many organizations I've worked in, quite oblivious to what some of my colleagues, female colleagues in particular, might be going through.
And it's there all the time. And I think, you know, women are very sort of, we learn very early how to kind of protect yourself and, mm-hmm. and how to behave in certain ways that men just aren't exposed to at such a young age in the same ways, or certainly when I was growing up. You know, I can't speak for kids now because of, you know, internet and social media. I'm sure they have different pressures, but
it's like verbal and non-verbal cues to, like, yeah. you know, stay away.
Yeah, and you know, there was a little while back that there sort of leaked document from the British government about, you know, various interns and people who'd made a document about, well, you want to stay away from him after a few drinks because he gets a bit, you know, handy in the taxi. And, you know, and this is not surprising to women. We all have that, right? You know, it might not be written down and it might not get published in the papers. But, you know, when you join an organization, you quite quickly figure out, okay, if you're going to a conference and there's a drinks event, you probably want to stay away from this guy and that guy. Or, you know, you might want to go to bed early, or, you know, you just have to, like, look after yourself. And again, you know, for a long time, I accepted that as just the way that the world is. And increasingly, I think, no, organisations are condoning this. You know, it's known. These are not secrets in organisations. But it's kind of a blind eye is turned. And I think, it manifests all the time in all sorts of ways. So, you know, that could be a crass comment like the one I've just mentioned, but it doesn't even need to be that. It could be being in a meeting where you get talked over the whole time, and other people make the point that you've just made,
right.
And you know, those kind of things which we've all read about, they happen all the time to women, and we're very used to it. And of course, if you're then an ethnic minority woman, happens even more, and other things happen which are even more challenging. And you know, the class dimension comes into it as well. So, you know, I grew up in the north. I don't sound like it anymore because it was just easier to not have my background foregrounded, if that makes sense, in those kind of contexts. It was easier to pretend that I was as posh as everyone else because it just got rid of some of the crap that I was dealing with. It's kind of inbuilt in women, I think, to have that mentality, like, you know, you walk with your keys in your hand in case someone attacks you. That's a thing that women do all the time, and men are surprised by. But that's just the reality that we've grown up with. And, you know, that happens in the workplace as well. You just get used to protecting yourself, and you get used to it not fitting around you fitting around it in a way that I think men perhaps experience less, certainly the ones I've spoken to about it. So, you know, the thing of there not being enough ladies' toilets, there not being, you know, all the floors being very difficult to walk on in heels, you know, it's like these are just things that women accept. And, you know, we saw it with the NASA spacewalk yesterday where it's had to be cancelled because they don't have enough spacesuits that fit women. It's like, this is not hard, guys, right? This is not a hard problem to solve. You put people on the moon, you can make a spacesuit in a smaller size. You know, you just have chosen not to. And that speaks to who's making the decisions and what kind of criteria they put into those decisions, I guess, which are just not the one that the same as women might have. It's sort of everywhere. I think it's in social life, but also corporate life in the terms of the way these things play out.
Yeah, I was really surprised. You know, when the Me Too movement kind of blew up, and you know, part of me was shocked and appalled. You know, who are these men that do this? But then it's like, no, this is, you hear, oh, no, this happens quite regularly. It was eye opening when, certainly for me, when all of the various revelations came to the fore. And I think many of us just haven't been paying much attention as men.
Yeah, and you know, it's easy to ignore. If it's not happening to you, it's easy to ignore if it is, because it happens so frequently that you can't fight every battle. So you end up just picking the ones that, you know, you feel really strongly about. But you do let a lot of stuff go, just because partly it's easier for your sanity, but also, you know, it does damage you professionally if you're always the person calling these things out, you know, and some people don't want to be that person. So, you know, there's always a decision to make there about how far you go. Like, and, you know, there's also, for me, there's always been this tension between part of the way to get around that is to succeed in business as a woman and be able to kind of influence the culture from a position of leadership or seniority.
But then you almost have to uber succeed.
Yeah. Right? You have to succeed twice as much. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And go far above what might be expected.
Yeah. And also, part of how you succeed inevitably involves accepting some things that you're not comfortable with. You know, so I had a former boss who was, you know, a wonderful man in all sorts of ways, But he was very old school, very blokey old school. And, you know, he'd go off on business trips and then I'd go in to see him about something and he'd show me all these photos he'd taken of women on the beach in Brazil in bikinis. And I'm like, you know, I don't want to see this, but you're my boss. I need something from you, like, or I need to have a conversation with you. And, you know, how far do you push that? Like, you can jokily say, oh, that's great. Can we talk about X or Y? But you're still being exposed to something like that. And you're still having to accept it to a degree just to get where you need professionally. So it's like, I always found it a real dilemma. Like, am I doing more good by being a woman who's succeeding and role modeling that for other women? Or am I doing more harm by not calling these things out?
You're in a position of power. You can call this stuff out. And if you don't, then...
Yeah, then are you actually as bad as, you know, are you part of the problem sort of thing? So that was a real challenge for me, I think. And something I still sort of, I'm not sure how far I got it right. And I think, again, that's if you don't experience that kind of everyday micro kind of aggression or micro sexism or whatever it might be, you're not thinking in that way. Whereas I think, you know, for women, that's quite common to be having those kind of conversations with themselves and having to decide what kind of boss they're going to be, because actually, you know, to get there is really hard, and then you have to be better than the blokes to get the same level of kind of success.
And I'm sure there are some that sort of they get there, but then it's, you know, what I have, I hold, and you know, it's just the self-interest might.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I have friends who say, "Oh, I hate working for women because actually, to get to the positions that they're in, they've had to be really tough and they've had to take a lot of crap, and therefore they don't kind of
they don't give a lot."
They
don't put up with stuff.
Yeah, they've built their barriers, and they have to keep them up. You know, and I understand why people say that, but it frustrates me because it's a response to, again, a flawed kind of system. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand why women go that way. It's something I tried not to do, but, you know, inevitably you do sort of go, well, I've had to put up with this, so, you know, this is just the way it is. And I, you know, I can't be responsible for everybody. But equally, yeah, it's, you know, it's a defense mechanism, basically.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about organizational culture and where things are. Obviously the UK is where you do your work, so in UK organizations, what does the data say in terms of diversity and inclusion? What have you found?
It does reinforce a lot of these, how a lot of these things play out. So, you know, we've all seen the gender pay data published by organizations over 250 employees. Largely, I think 85-90% of people have a gap between male and female pay in favor of men. A very, very small number have a gap in favor of women. But there's no reason why that should be there if you think rationally about it. And of course, there are lots and lots of reasons that go into that. But one of the things that's frustrated me is the narratives that some companies have created around that. It's been, it's not that we pay men and women differently, which they have to say because that's actually illegal. But, you know, realistically, there's something going on here. And then they'll say it's because we don't have many women in leadership positions. And it's like, well, yeah, of course it is, right? You know, if all of your women are in junior roles, then there is going to be a pay gap, right? So why are we not thinking about that? Why are we not saying, well, why are there so few women in senior roles in so many organizations? You know, why are there more men called John running companies than there are women in the FTSE 350? You know, that's just weird, right? Like, rationally, that's just weird. But we're so used to it that it almost just becomes, well, we just don't have many women in leadership, as though that in itself is an explanation rather than a symptom, you know.
Yes.
So there's interesting data coming out. And of course, you know, one of the complexities is that the gender pay data that's published is quite a blunt tool. And there are easy ways to kind of game that data to make it look better. So an organization in publishing announced the biggest gap in publishing last year, which was 41%, which is huge for a female-dominated industry like publishing, which is, estimates suggest, 70 to 80% female employees. And this year, they announced that they were recruiting a female CEO for the first time, which is, you know, great, but also is going to help their pay gap quite significantly this year because they've parachuted in a very senior woman. probably on a very good package, which is great for her, but the systemic issues are still there. The gap's just going to look a bit smaller this year. And equally, we've got other companies whose gaps are starting to get bigger and they're getting a lot of criticism. But of course, what they're doing is building the pipeline from the bottom, which is going to take time. And there will be, you know, ups and downs in the data while they do that, because there's a big problem to correct. And you're constrained by the roles that you have, the staff turnover that you have, you know, the skills that you need, all sorts of other things go into that. So, like, my interest, I guess, is in getting underneath what companies are putting out there and saying what's really going on. The problem is that people will use sort of high-level data as an excuse, and they're reluctant to go much deeper into it. So that's where I'm trying to encourage companies to say, look, this is not about a blame game. We are where we are, but we need to understand why, and we need to understand what in your culture is creating these situations where women don't progress or people from ethnic minorities don't progress or, you know, whatever it might be. And we need to address what's really going on, not just fix the pay thing, but understand why women don't get to senior positions or why ethnic minorities are not recruited or, you know.
Can we talk a little bit about some what you found some of those reasons to be? I mean, I always, so as a risk person, one of the best things you can do is have diversity of opinions, certainly at senior levels throughout the organization, of course, but certainly when there are decisions to be made to, you know, for all sorts of reasons, to bring different perspectives into what you're trying to do, to avoid, you know, groupthink and confirmation bias and all sorts of things. So, you know, it's valuable to have a diversity of opinions, certainly at senior levels.
Yeah.
So why aren't we there yet?
I think we're not there because it takes a degree of personal risk and discomfort to surround yourself with very diverse opinions, right? I mean, you will know this, but in a lot of contexts, you will see, you know, a CEO come in and they will kind of reshape the senior team and they'll bring in their people.
Their people, yeah.
And what they mean by their people is people that they know that they can work with and who kind of have the same sort of ideas and who will support them.
That also happens, you know, in the interviewing phase, right?
There's absolutely.
That sort of first round across any organization you've ever interviewed. It's what's the cultural fit, you know?
Yeah.
And that always feels a little bit weird, right?
Yeah.
You know, how would you fit culturally in the organization?
Yeah.
So I guess it happens throughout from senior all the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Way down.
And of course the problems are compounded at senior level because often those roles are less transparently recruited for, or they're recruited for in certain kinds of ways, either through referrals or through personal connections, all of which, again, disadvantages women, for example, disadvantages ethnic minorities who are less likely to have those networks. And it tends to be less transparent. You know, there's not necessarily a formal structured interview process that everybody can observe happening and know that it's fair. So, you know, that allows a lot of things that potentially recruiting for a more junior post you wouldn't get away with because it has to be more transparent and, you know, different kind of rules apply, I guess, whether that's explicitly stated or not. I think when I think of sort of leaders in organizations I've been in, most of them will tend to surround themselves with people that they feel comfortable with. And, you know, that's understandable. We're social animals and, you know, you want to enjoy your work and you want to work with people that you get on with. But that's where the risk comes in, I think, because then you do get groupthink. And I've seen that a lot, you know, where it's like violent agreement about an issue rather than someone saying, well, hang on, isn't there another way to think about this? Or maybe we need to get some different points of view in the room. And of course, it's much more comfortable to have a board meeting where everyone agrees. You know, and you all feel good, you've made some decisions and everybody feels good about them and you know, that's great. But of course the quality of the decision then is compromised because nobody's really debated it.
There's also a big concern, well, that's come up in previous episodes of this podcast around systemic risk and take the global financial crisis, for instance. Pick whatever country, the non-executive directors, they just of the major corporates of that country, they're all the sort of same people that sit on, you know, each other's boards.
Yeah.
And it's just this community of the same people. Well, how is that going to inject different thinking about some of the big challenges that, you know, those companies face.
Yeah, and I think we sometimes underestimate how easy it is to get conditioned by a culture. So, you know, we've all seen it where you join an organization and you shake things up a bit, mm-hmm. you know, coming in maybe at a sort of middle or senior management level, you've been brought in to make some changes and you can see the problems of the organization very clearly because you have that fresh perspective. But over time...
Right, you start to go native.
Yeah, you go native. And that's partly because it's easier. Mm-hmm. but also it's just hard to... It's hard to always be the outlier. Mm-hmm. And I think over time...
Also training.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, you're constantly, that's constantly reinforced. So you'll have your performance review and you will be told, well, you know, this is great, but actually, mm-hmm. you know, you've upset a few people with this, or you've made some ripples by doing that. So you start thinking, well, is it really worth it? You know, do they really want me to make these changes in this organization, or, you know, are they kind of paying lip service to it? And, you know, you do sort of get institutionalized into a culture, and therefore things which, you know, an outsider would find unacceptable start to seem acceptable, mm-hmm. and you don't, your boundaries change around all of that. And of course the financial crisis is a classic example of that, where, you know, you ask the average person if they understood the context, they go, this is mad, these people should mm-hmm. not be doing this, you know, it makes no moral or rational sense. But of course if everyone's doing it and they're yeah. for a while seeming to be succeeding at doing it and it's benefiting them, suddenly it doesn't seem so bad anymore. So, you know, that's where I get interested, is like, as an organization, what are you condoning? And what kind of practices might emerge out of that that might, you know, hopefully would be really beneficial, but potentially might not be? And how does that put you, you know, as a human in that context? Where do you sit? How do you call that out if you're the person going, actually, I think some of this is wrong, but all the senior people are doing it. People are succeeding through doing these things. Do I just shut up and, you know, fit in? Do I leave? Do, you know, what mm-hmm. are my choices? And your choices are often quite limited in that context. So I'm really interested in how can organizations think differently about culture? So question I get a lot is, well, we've got this very strong corporate culture. Mm-hmm. You know, we have these values and we have, you know, which are often very, very positive things. And won't it be diluted if, you know, we start trying to, you know, if we stop hiring for cultural fit, for example,
right.
if we start to say, if we stop asking people, you know, will you fit mm-hmm. in the culture? It's like this, and trying to understand.
So I guess it depends on what those values are, because
yeah.
if those values are about integrity and
yeah.
doing the right thing, and obviously you want people that,
yeah.
that fit that with,
do
with
that.
Those things.
Yeah. And that's great. The point I will make to organizations is that's not really what you're doing, or mm. it can be not what you're doing, if that mm-hmm. makes sense. So I was looking at, I think it was KPMG, or anyway, it was one of the sort of big city firms, and they had their sort of values and their mission statement on their website, and it was, you know, we're very focused on the customer. It might have been Goldman Sachs, I can't remember, but anyway, we're very focused on the customer. The customer's needs come first. And if the customer is happy, our employees are happy. Now, like, oh, that's okay. That's, mm-hmm, you
sure.
know, that's a mission statement that they've come up with, or a set of sort of words and phrases, mm-hmm. which I'm sure they've chosen carefully. But the consequence of that, to me, is this is not an organization who is going to be receptive to people working flexibly or people contributing in a different
right.
way.
Mm-hmm.
They set their stall out.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to work,
we're
going to
bend
here.
Over backwards for our
yeah.
customers and
yeah.
employee well-being be damned or whatever.
Yeah. yeah, yeah. And of course, that's, I'm sure, not what their intention mm-hmm. was in making that statement, but that's how it reads to me. So I automatically think, well, you can't work there if you've got caring responsibilities mm-hmm. because they're not going to be receptive to you saying, I need to leave at four
yeah.
because
yeah.
I have to pick my kids up, or I have to take my mother to, you know, to the doctor or whatever. That's going to be a very difficult environment to succeed if that's your work-life situation. And, you know, conversely, you get people like Virgin saying, we believe our employees are the most important thing, and if they're happy, the customers are happy. Again, you could argue there are challenges around that as well, but that's what interests me, I think. Like,
mm-hmm.
what, you know, is your culture really as positive as you set out
mm-hmm.
when you made that statement? You know, because they didn't make that statement going, we don't care about our employees. They were just trying to make the point of we value our customers, right? But the unseen consequence of that. And what that means is, you're going to have people self-select out of working for that company before they even apply. So I'm not going to apply to work there because I'm going, well, this sounds
mm.
hideous.
Mm.
You know, like, I, of course the customer should be happy. That's how business works. But I can't sacrifice 100% of my life to that, you know. So good people are self-selecting out of that process. And therefore you get a hugely skewed culture, which, like I say, I'm sure was not the intention, but it's definitely a consequence. And you see that all the time with companies, how they talk about themselves, and they don't realise how they're creating barriers and saying, you have to be this sort of person to work here. And that's where you then
get super interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And then you get the groupthink because, oh, well, only this sort of person fits in here and this sort of person succeeds here. So if you're that sort of person, great, you apply, you get the job, you succeed. Everybody else either doesn't apply, doesn't get the job, doesn't get the promotion, and therefore groupthink, because suddenly everybody who's running the company is the same.
They're all clones, yeah.
Yeah. So that's where the sort of problem comes in, I think. So it's, you know, sometimes it's conscious, sometimes it's about a
leader. And in big firms, that's almost a badge of honor. It's like, oh, he's a Goldman guy, or oh, yeah, he's a McKinsey guy, so he's going to be like this or like that. So and I suppose there's some good things about that.
Yeah.
In terms of how some, you know, these people might think, or the training that they've received, yeah, or the, yeah, experiences that they've had. But on the flip side, there's you're not getting, you're missing opportunities because
absolutely,
you're not bringing in diverse,
yeah,
people.
Yeah.
The way in which you work is perhaps, you're perhaps creating in some ways unintended consequences in your,
yeah,
culture. And culture is really interesting to me because,
yeah,
it's this thing, you know, that classic definition, it's what people do when no one's watching.
Mm.
And ever since the global financial crisis, there's this emphasis on culture, but it's this, how do you measure that? What does that look like actually? And it can become very fluffy. But
yeah,
what I want to talk a little bit with you about now is just how can we look at data and how can we use analytics and things to actually measure what that looks and feels like?
Yeah. So, I mean, my belief around this is that there are hundreds and thousands of data points about the culture, mm-hmm, of every organization all the time. So,
mm-hmm,
when you walk into the office, when you go to the canteen, when, you know, these are all data points about the kind of way we do,
right,
things around,
right,
here and how we work around here. So, you know, do you go into the office and all the meeting room, how are the meeting rooms named is a favorite one of mine,
right,
you know, and you will often see, I went to a co-working space the other day and the meeting spaces were all named after explorers.
Right.
So they were all men. You know, because actually we kind of probably haven't really got that,
right,
many,
right,
female explorers that we could name,
right,
from the Victorian,
right,
era.
Yeah, Shackleton Room and the...
Exactly,
blah, blah, blah,
right.
Right.
So that's the message about,
mm-hmm,
you know, the corporate culture that all employees are absorbing, just going, you know, from meeting to meeting.
It's a subliminal message,
yeah,
but it's you absorb it, don't,
yeah,
you
absorb,
mm-hmm,
it. And, you know, my particular interest is in linguistic sort of cues around culture and the data points there. So what words and phrases and kind of ways of talking about an organization exist, and what are the kind of connotations of those, as I say, you know, not the intended consequence of saying we value, you know, integrity, honesty, commitment, all,
mm-hmm,
of those things, but what are the connotations of that for different people, and how does that impact on the way that people view that company and the way they feel included or excluded in that company. So, you know, when companies say to me, oh, we don't have a lot of data, or it's really hard to quantify culture, I say it's hard, but it's not impossible, because organizations generate material all the time about themselves. You know, they have websites, they have individuals who go out,
mm-hmm,
to conferences, they have salespeople who are out talking to customers. You know, they're constantly generating information and data about the company to share with people about, this is what we do, this is how we do it, these are the people that we work with. All of that is data. It's more challenging, potentially, to understand than a spreadsheet of pay data or, you know, by counting the number of people at a certain,
mm-hmm,
level or whatever, but it's still data. And the more that you can capture that and look for those sort of themes and, you know, motifs that come out, the more you will understand what the culture really is, rather than what the kind of maybe the mission statement intention of the culture was or is. So that's where I get very interested in kind of harvesting corporate communications, really, which could be internal or external.
Mm-hmm.
It could be, you know, job adverts. It could be, you know, their mission statement. It could be how they write their company report and what they, you know, that tells you what they value as an organization. And I find that very interesting. And there's often a gap between perhaps what the intention is of the organization and what the reality is for the people who work there.
Well, could we, first of all, maybe take a step back and just, if you could perhaps explain to my listeners the company that you founded, Umbrella Data, and what the origin story of that, and then talk a little bit about some of the examples of the work that you do in that space. Yeah. I think that'd be fascinating.
Okay, so Umbrella is basically bringing data analytics to this whole conversation about diversity and inclusion, which is something which is quite absent often in the discussion. It's a very qualitative kind of space where there's lots of people doing good work, but it tends to be culture's hard to quantify, so we talk to people, we try to understand the culture that way, and then we build interventions for individuals or teams. What I'm interested in is really getting beyond that to the kind of bigger picture of the organization. So the kind of things that I started off doing was looking at things like the gender pay data and trying to get more insights underneath that, and putting that into a bigger context. So for an organization to be able to say, okay, here's my gender pay data, here's my competitors, which obviously they can look at through the open data, although surprisingly few actually do regularly. But also there's a bigger context, a societal context in which an organization operates. So where are you based? Where's your office? Where, you know, what kind of demographic is in your region? You know, so for example, working in Cambridge is very different to working in London in terms of the people that you can recruit. The talent pool is different just by the demographics of who lives there and who works there. So I'm trying to find those bigger sort of context to put them in, to say, you know, maybe you don't have 50% women on the board, but maybe that's sort of okay in your context because of the types of, you know, people you have available to recruit from or whatever. I mean, it's generally not okay, but you know, there are different ways to kind of set those targets, I guess. So, you know, when organizations sort of say, oh, we're going to have 30% women on the board by 2020, great, it's a noble target. But when you break that down, is that realistic? You know, how many roles do you have at that level? How many women do you have in the pipeline who might be eligible for that kind of promotion in the next 2 to 3 years? You know, how many people below them? You know, how is that going to happen? How often do those roles become available, and how are they recruited for, and how are they, you know, filled? How do people succeed? There's all sorts of things going on there. So it's not enough to just say we'll just get some women in. It's about all the things that have to go around to make that successful, which is where you get into culture. But again, that's where I started looking for other ways to get data into that discussion. So you've got your kind of, okay, this is the number of people we have, and this is their demographic, and this is what it looks like. But you then need to tackle, well, what's their experience going to be of the culture of that organization at that level? Or, you know, if these targets are achieved, are they going to succeed, or is the culture fundamentally unchanged but you've done something about the numbers? So I started developing sort of textual analytics software using artificial intelligence, natural language processing, which will essentially kind of enables me to ingest lots and lots of content.
So what is that? So as a complete sort of neophyte in this, so what I'm imagining when you say that is you've developed some really whizzy software that can, I don't know, take a read of an annual report and then pull out some data or some insights based on that. Is that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I've built, through sort of academic research, I built a dictionary, I suppose, a kind of lexicography of the types of language that you want to look out for as being indicators of an inclusive culture or a potentially a culture which would be less inclusive to women or to ethnic minorities or to people from socioeconomically disadvantaged backgrounds. There's lots of ways that those cues are given through language. You know, so a sort of crass example would be, do you talk about leadership and you say he, you know, our leaders are this, you know, and you talk about them as male. Now, that's much less common now than perhaps 20 years ago, but it still happens. But yeah, so what we can do then is ingest a large amount of text and simply look for patterns exactly as you would with numbers. You're saying, are there certain words that come up a lot? Are there repeated uses of words which are gendered, either masculine or feminine, which give you cues about the kind of culture that you're creating? And then you're able to say, okay, how does this, what are the consequences of this? And the research tells us that men, which maybe goes back to your sort of first point, really, men are much less sensitized to gendered language than women are. So you can very easily change language to include more feminized terms without it putting men off that culture. So, you know, thinking of a job advert, changing some of the words that you use there statistically can improve your chances of recruiting women and will have no effect on the number of men who apply. So, you know, we're more sensitized as women. We're going, well, actually, if it says competitive, dynamic, aggressive, you know, whatever, I'm not feeling that. But if it talks about, you know, developing you, and, you know, there are other kinds of words which will make women go,
actually, that to me sounds like there'd be a huge incentive if you're hiring, because you want to, you know, you want to expand the pool in which you might find the right candidate. And if you're not looking in the right area, you might miss someone great that you wouldn't have applied
and
otherwise.
So much of this happens before the application process. So, you know, we've seen a lot of development around debiasing the application process and taking names off CVs and, you know, trying to do competence-based recruitment rather than, you know, looking at people's background and history and school and university and all that kind of thing, which is great. But the gap is, who are the people who never even apply? That's the bit where I get interested. You know, when I look at a job advert, or, you know, anyone looks at a job advert and goes, oh, that's not the company for me. You know, that might be right. It might not be the company for me, but it might be. And they just haven't been intentional enough about the way they've talked about leadership in the organization or whatever. So, you know, they might be unintentionally sending a message to me that it's not a place I want to work. And actually, maybe it would be. So I get interested in how people select out of that process before it even begins. Because obviously you can capture data about who you've interviewed, who's applied, who gets through the pipeline, and all of that needs to be interrogated as well. But who never even gets there? Who just says, no, oh God, that's not
right.
The job
I mean,
for
me. if you put out a job advert where, I don't know if it's a sales role, you know, aggressive pursuit of sales targets or whatever it is, and you right off the bat, you're going to get 90% of your applicants are male. Well, chances are it's going to be a male that gets into the role.
Yeah, precisely. And, you know, nobody wants to get to a situation where we're saying you can't recruit the best person for the job. But what we want to do is say, but are you creating the opportunity?
Are you looking at the right? Are you casting a wide enough net to find the right candidate?
And are you creating the equality of opportunity for everyone to feel that they can apply for that role and have a chance of succeeding? Then yes, you can say with confidence we've recruited the best person for the job. But if you're only talking to half the talent pool, how can you say with confidence you've got the best person for the job? You know, the 50% of the population may not have been interested in applying.
And you can just do that by altering the language.
Yeah, it's cheap, it's easy. You know, if you're a large organization, you recruit all the time, you know, you've got volumes of data about how you've talked about roles and the organization and who's applied. Look at that data would be my advice. You know, it's there. You've got the job adverts that you put out. You can see who applied. You can see where you've got challenges. You may not know how to fix them, but you can start to identify, okay, we haven't got to the right people. And another thing I see a lot, which is sort of slightly more on the number crunching side, but companies, so to use publishing as an example, but, you know, it's common. Every industry has its kind of trade publications or its, you know, sources where they look for candidates. So in publishing, you know, when I started out, all the jobs were in the Media Guardian on a Monday. So it's like, well, you know, that's where you go and look for a job. Or the bookseller, when you're in publishing, that's the kind of trade Bible where people advertise. But of course, you're advertising to people who know about publishing and who already want to be in that career and who know that that's where they have to look, right? So you're not going to attract ethnic minority candidates in the same way because you're not reaching them in the same way. So, you know, if you look at the readership of those types of literature, it's vastly skewed towards white, well-educated people. And then I have companies say, well, we just can't seem to find candidates from ethnic minorities. Well, not if you're advertising in the bookseller, because they're already not in the industry. So how would they know that that's where they need to look? You know, you need to do something different about that. So you need to change the language. You need to talk differently about the roles and the culture. But you also need to go to where those people are looking.
That's so interesting, particularly as, you know, as the world continues to change so rapidly. With things like AI and automation, the roles, the one of the things that I think is very clear is that all of these technological changes won't necessarily displace, they'll displace certain jobs, obviously, certain jobs will go away, but they will also create new ones that we don't even know exist.
Yeah.
And so we need to be able to recruit the right sorts of people for these new roles that will involve more of what makes us human. So curiosity, creativity, all of those kinds of things. In order to find those people, we need to cast as wide a net as possible.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about is extremely powerful.
Yeah, and it's very interesting how easy it is to be unintentional about these things. So, you know, if you look at the demographics of social media, and of course it changes very rapidly, but, you know, I remember when Facebook was, you know, new, and everyone I know of my generation has a Facebook account, but you look at the demographics, people younger than 30... they're not really Facebook users, you know. So again, your own prejudices about how people recruit for roles, or your own kind of experiences of how you did it when you get into a leadership position, are not going to be relevant.
Totally different,
And again, LinkedIn is a great example. Mm. Everyone says, well, we always put our jobs on LinkedIn. Again, LinkedIn is very white when you look at the demographics.
Right.
You know, so, okay, great, you've put it on LinkedIn, and people will find it on Google because LinkedIn's very good at SEO, but you're not targeting where you've got a gap. You're targeting where you're already speaking to the converted, if you like. You know, these people already know about your organization. They're on LinkedIn. They've got their profile. They've got their network. You know, they already know that you're there. How are you getting to the people you don't know about and don't know about you? That's the interesting piece for me. So what are the social media channels? I mean, I don't know the answer to that because I'm, you know, old and out of touch. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe you need to be on Snapchat. Maybe you need, maybe there's some new thing that people are looking at. Or maybe they're looking at, you know, more generic job sites like Monster.com or, you know, Indeed.com or whatever. But simply putting things in the same place as you've always put them is not going to get you to a new audience, at least not now. You know, technology obviously changes all the time and those things will become more and more discoverable. But, you know, these are relatively simple things to change for an organization. Mm-hmm. You know, change the language of your job advert. It's going to take you, you know, 10 minutes. Put it in a different place where you're going to pay to advertise it anyway. So just divert some of that budget to a different channel and see what happens, you know, and see if you widen the talent pool.
What about internal comms? If you want to make a change happen within the organization, I presume similarly you can use some of these techniques to make better messages that reach your internal audience more effectively.
Yeah, and I think, again, I think like the way that people think internally about an organization, there's a lot of data around that. You know, there's all of your, there's what you're generating as an organization in terms of intranet sites and training manuals and all of those kind of things. But there's also the way that your community in the organization interacts. You know, are they posting on an intranet? Mm-hmm. Do they have chat? Do they have, you know, how are they interacting? These are all data points that you have. And yeah, again, you can start to say, okay, we're seeing certain themes come up here. We're seeing certain ways of talking about this organization that repeatedly come up. Is that something we're happy with? Are those good and positive ways that people talk about the organization, or are there some themes which we need to tackle? So yeah, I think in that sort of cultural change thing, there's a big piece there about the kind of language and the way that you approach that. And I think people are nervous about it because it feels less quantifiable than looking at numbers. And it is in many ways. It's a sort of nascent data pool, I guess, that we haven't been used to dealing with in quite this way. But we will get better and better
there,
at
right?
it. It's
we're using it. I mean, the Googles of the world and the Facebooks of the world are using our data in all kinds of ways.
Absolutely.
So
why
not take some of that and quantify it and start to use that internally.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, think, you know, if all the Facebook and the various scandals around the way data is used has told us anything, it's that we're not as different as we think we are from each other. You know, it's very, very easy for Facebook to nail you in ways that you like to think as an individual you're very unique and nobody could possibly be like me, but actually from a Facebook perspective, you're this person, this age, this, you know, amount of friends, whatever it is that builds that picture, and therefore you're going to want this advert or this piece of content, and they're pretty good at it, not perfect but pretty good. So we can do the same right in our organizations. We can say, how do we want these people to feel? How do we, what kind of culture do we want to create for our employees, and how do we therefore understand the data that we've got about them to see where we've got challenges or see where we could do things better? And it's not as straightforward as just looking at a spreadsheet and paying everyone a bit more money. Not that that's straightforward either, but it's more complicated, but it's definitely doable. You know, Facebook do it, as you say, and you can do that for positive reasons within an organization, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to touch on a couple of things. There's actually so much that we can talk about. Perhaps taking a step back, big picture wise first. And so there's this this book that came out. I don't know how to pronounce this gentleman's surname, but Thomas Chamorro Premusich, who wrote this book on why so many incompetent men get ahead.
Yeah.
And I know we've touched on it, but it might be interesting to get your take on that.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting. It's obviously very,
because I've worked with many over the years, not necessarily where I am, but over the years, you look at someone and you say, my God,
they've been promoted here above their skill set.
Is that the Peter principle, where people get promoted up to their point of incompetence?
Right. Yeah, and that's really common, right? And
it is common, right? So you get good at a thing, but then the next level, you're not doing the thing that got you there.
And I think there's a whole load of stuff that goes into that. And obviously, like, I haven't read the book. I've seen a couple of interviews with him, but and he's obviously, being deliberately provocative with that kind of headline. But there is a kind of kernel of truth around how we think about these things. So, like you say, you can get very good at doing a specific functional thing or running a specific functional set of tasks. That doesn't mean that you're going to be great at strategy or leadership or all the other things. And I think we miss that those are different skills, and we're very, our organizations are still very hierarchical. There's a sense that you want to be going up all the time, and that's changing, but it's still there. Who's the boss?
It's implicit all the time. How big's your budget? How many team members do you have?
How many staff do you have? And all of that sort of reinforces certain types of behaviors. You're going to get people who are good at that, who are good at empire building, for example. We've all seen it in an organization. Person X has just inherited another department, building their empire. We all know those people, and they may or may not be the best people to run a department of 500 staff. They may not be great at people management or whatever, but they're good at something else. They're good at some sort of political maneuvering that gains them that power. And I think that's the trick to me about this sort of question of incompetent men getting ahead, or incompetence basically getting ahead, is we judge the wrong qualities when we look at those types of roles. So, do you want an organization to be run by people who are really politically astute at grabbing power? You might want some of that in your organization. I'm sure there are benefits. But if that's how you build your organization.
If that's the sole metric, right? You need some of that, because organizations are political entities, and you need to be able to maneuver and manage stakeholders, et cetera. But if that's the sole reason why you're there, that probably is not a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. And as an organization, have you created the space for people who are different to succeed? Or is everyone just empire building at the top? Because then you've got a problem, right? Because they're going to spend all their time protecting their fiefdoms and expanding their fiefdoms and not thinking about the future of the business. So I don't know, it's an interesting one. So a sort of concrete example of this, a colleague of mine from years ago was recruited into a very senior role in an organization, and essentially they said to her when she started, we brought you in because we have a guy running this department, but he's not very good at people, so we kind of need someone to manage people. Well, that's a bit weird, right? Why is he running a department of 100 people if he's not very good at people? And again, it's not that he didn't have lots of good skills. It's just that he was not doing a role that got the best out of those skills. So instead of addressing that as an organization, they just chucked another body in to kind of solve that problem. And it's like, well, actually, we need to just think differently about these things, And the reason was, of course, if they'd said to him, we don't want you to manage 100 people because that's not your skill set, he would have left, because he would have felt like his power was being kind of removed. But actually, it's perfectly fine. He was good at other things. Someone else should have been doing the people management. I don't have a problem with that sort of division of duties, but it's about, well, hang on, why as an organization have you got to that point? Why have you promoted that person to the point of incompetence in that particular skill? There's something weird going on there that sort of, to me, needs addressing.
I think it comes down to this implicit assumption that everybody wants to move up the hierarchy and have a bigger staff and a bigger budget.
Yeah. And it comes to what we value as well as a kind of, you know, as individuals and as a culture and an organization. You know, in that instance, there was a sense of, you know, he's the businessman, he can do the deals and, you know, do the negotiations and, you know, is really effective at all of that stuff. But we need someone who can do the fluffy stuff. Let's get a woman in and pay her a bit less, because that's a kind of female task, and female tasks are historically less financially valued by society. You know, we know about all the unpaid work that women do and how low-paid jobs tend to be skewed towards women. Those kind of skills are not valued often in organisations, as opposed to the kind of hard business skills that in this context were seen as being like things he could do, but we need some softer skills. We'll get a woman in, but, you know, we'll pay her a bit less because that's not really important. You know, we sort of feel we should do something about it, but we don't value it as much as his ability to go and negotiate better prices or make better sales. So I think we have to think about that. How do we value those skills? You know, which is not to say that being good at people management is a female-only skill, but there is a question about how the sort of gendered nature of society places different values on different skills. And that's why incompetent men get ahead, right? Because we have decided that we value, I don't know, logic and goal orientation in organisations rather than the ability to build a community or a network or make people feel good about their jobs. Now, ideally, you want both of those things, right? But in fact, we've skewed it very much one way. And therefore, we get incompetent men in those positions. And then we go, oh, they're not very good at people. Well, of course they're not, because that's never been what you valued them for. And you need to think about that earlier on, you know.
Right.
Not just ending up with loads of men on the board who aren't very good at people. Well, then you've got a problem, right? So,
right.
You know, it's about how we value these different attributes and skills that people bring, I think, and the different ways that people work. And it's not obviously not just about male, female. That's just a kind of good way to use it as an example, because most people have that.
Right. I mean, there's, you know, cultural, the socioeconomic differences that people can bring. I think, you know, the people who come from an immigrant background might have a different take on things, overcoming challenges, etc. We're fast running out of time, and I'll give you an easier, not so easy one. I'm very interested in your take on the Jordan Peterson phenomenon.
Yeah.
And particularly, you used the words equality of opportunity earlier, and he's talked a lot about equality of opportunity versus equality of outcome. I'm just curious what your take is on the kind of messages he has conveyed.
Yeah, so I think he is very clever in the way that he talks about the different data points that he's referring to. So, you know, I was rewatching the interview with Kathy Newman on Channel 4 and sort of trying to deconstruct a little bit what my take on it was. And so one thing I found very interesting that he said was, oh, you know, you would never do univariate analysis if you're looking at data. You would always do multivariate analysis because there's always more than one factor affecting everything.
Yeah.
You know, hard to disagree with that if you're a data scientist. But the next leap is the problematic one. So the next leap he makes is, you know, women are paid less, but there are lots of other variables in that, right? Again, agreed. And the one that he picks is, you know, the data tells that that people who rank high on amiability are paid less. So he's desegregating that from the gender conversation and saying, you know, there are lots of other factors about why people are paid what they're paid, and amiability is one.
Right.
But what that's missing is that women are conditioned to be amiable, and as a society, we don't financially value amiability as much as we do, I don't know, aggression or goal orientation or competitiveness or, you know, whatever the opposite might be.
Right.
So, you know, individually you could say, yes, that thing he said is true, that thing he said is true, that thing he said is true, but to me it's the links between those that get missed. So why do we pay people who are amiable less? That's the question, right? And we know that they're more likely to be women statistically because we're conditioned as women to be more, you know, interactive, more empathetic, you know, all of those things. Society tells us that's what women should be, and men don't need to be that. So it's a false kind of separation of those two qualities, I think. He's saying women get paid less, but so do people who are less amiable. In fact, the Venn diagram is very, very, you know, overlapping there. So I think, you know, he's obviously a provocateur, and he obviously enjoys that. And
he gets a lot of money
he makes a lot of money out of it. And, you know, again, it's a very interesting interview for all sorts of reasons.
I so wish that the interview went in the direction that you just took it, as opposed to the direction that it went, because it just stayed at a very surface level.
It did.
And got very, you know, the reactions were very emotional and visceral. And I don't think it helps very much.
Yeah, I think, and again, it's a difficult one, you know. Mm. I mean, again, women will often be judged for getting emotional, in inverted commas, in those types of situations. But there's a reason for that, right? It's the anger of 40 years of having to put up with this shit, you know. But also it's about, you know, again, how we value people differently, and, you know.
Oh, men get emotional. I mean, he was emotional in that.
He was angry.
You can tell how angry. You could see how angry he was.
Yeah, he's just more contained, I guess, in the way that he expresses it. But yeah, so that's to me the interesting thing. Like, you know, I always go back to, so my PhD, I studied Salman Rushdie, who I'm a very interested in the way that he writes and the way that he thinks. But I went to see him talk live, and he was talking about the fatwa and, you know, the challenges of free speech. And he said, you know, it's really easy to defend free speech when you agree with the person, and it's really hard when you don't. And that's kind of an obvious statement, but when you think about the consequences of that, that's where you get into the Jordan Peterson kind of debate. Like, do I agree with him that there's no such thing as gender discrimination in pay? No, I don't. Do I think there should be a debate about that? Yes. And I think he should be putting those points forward, but I think equally we need to then be interrogating them very, you know,
it's also very nuanced. As I trained as an economist, and, you know, multivariate regressions. Well, you can play with the data very easily to get different results. So I have no idea what these studies do and say. But but statistically, you know, it's data in the social sciences is never black and white.
No, exactly. And if you go looking for something, often you can find it. Or, you know, there are data points which you will take in that confirm that, you know, whereas others you may not be looking for, and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I think the challenge with him is that the way that he talks about it sounds very rational, but actually you need to get under that and say, okay, but there's a link missing here, or there's a leap that's gone further, you know, and is ignoring something that actually links these two different data points of amiability and gender, which contribute to the overall picture. Well, they're not two separate groups.
Two data points that are correlated. So you're almost again, I don't want to get into the statistical machinations of all of that, but, you know, it's interesting.
It's interesting, and it's interesting that, you know, these are, you know, his visibility is provoking discussion. Mm-hmm. I'm all for discussion, right? I'm all for that freedom of speech thing where we can get this stuff out and we can agree, you know, respectfully disagree, challenge, and allow people to make their own minds up. You know, the problem is, obviously, do we all have equal access to that voice? And that's, again, you know, that's another set of challenges, but probably a longer conversation.
One more I'm going to try and squeeze in here before we wrap up, but unconscious bias training and your views on that, because and maybe at a very high level, we might have to get you to come back to talk in more detail around that. But I was very interested in your post on that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, organizations doing unconscious bias training.
And just for my listeners who don't know what it is.
Yeah, so essentially this is a kind of often the first stage of a diversity program for an organization, where they will say, we're going to roll out this unconscious bias training. And it's really intended to make people think about the kind of unknown prejudices or thought processes that they go through. Perhaps not, you know, consciously making decisions, but actually making decisions, you know, in the back of their mind, sort of thing. And unconscious bias training is intended to foreground that and say, well, maybe do you favour this type of person or that type of person without really knowing it. And that's, you know, it's a good message for an organisation to send, that we want to talk about this stuff. My concern is, you know, I always come from an evidence-based sort of point of view, and the evidence isn't there that that's actually going to drive meaningful change. And realistically, I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not a neuroscientist, but all the research that I've read tells me that these are very deeply ingrained things that, that come from all sorts of life experiences, and to expect a kind of one day training course to undo them, it's not going to happen, right? And I'm much more interested, I think, in thinking about, well, rather than trying to persuade every individual to be more aware of their biases, which is by its nature very, very difficult and very small scale, it's about individual interventions. I'm much more interested in saying, as an organisation, what kind of biases do we actually condone? So they're really conscious, actually, because we're saying we like this type of person, they fit in here, they do well here, let's go and find more people like that. So that's the kind of bias that I get more interested in, if we're really going to make a difference in some of these things. You know, talking to individuals is great, and that's part of the picture, but at an organisational level, those biases are embedded in the way that we do business, and they're what we need to tackle. We need to say, why do we only value this type of person? And what would happen if we changed that and expanded that category? What would the organisation look like then? Because then in an individual behaviour won't matter so much, because the organisation won't condone it in the way that it does at the moment. You know, so it's not just about what biases you have, it's about whether you get away with negative consequences of those biases for certain groups of people. So if you never recruit a woman and the organisation never picks you up on that, so what, really? You might become aware of it, but you don't necessarily have to change it. Whereas if the organisation says, actually, we've condoned this behaviour and we're not going to do it anymore, and we're going to hold people accountable, we're going to look at your hiring practices or your promotion practices, and we're going to interrogate why you never promote women or you never hire women, that's a different... that's going to make meaningful change, right? That person either leaves the organisation or their behaviour changes, because, you know, we're not that hard to motivate, right? We all have a bonus and a pay structure and an ambition and a whatever. Tie some accountability to it and you get change. Send people into meetings to talk about it and you'll get discussion, but you may not get the level of change that, that I would want to see.
Absolutely. We're going to have to wrap it up. But before we do, where can my listeners follow you, find more about Umbrella, all that good stuff?
So, yeah, they can. You can find me on social media. I'm usually at Umbrella Data, so I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You find me on LinkedIn, Nancy/Umbrella, Nancy-Umbrella, I think. And my website is umbrellaanalytics.net.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Nancy. This was great.
Thanks.
I could keep talking, but we've run out of time, so perhaps we'll have to get you to come back at some point.
It was great. I enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you.
All right. I hope you found that insightful. Check out Nancy and Umbrella Analytics, and also check out Nancy's equally insightful blog. Links are in the show notes as usual. And as mentioned at the outset, we've got a new course coming up. If you have a big decision to make, one that feels impossible, we've got you covered. How to make impossible decisions with calm and confidence will be out soon. Not only that, one of the course's 7 modules is out now, absolutely free of charge. Just go to all-things-risk.teachable.com. And you can check it out. That link is also in the show notes. And make sure you are on our mailing list to get notified when the full version of the course is live. And you can do that and also make sure that you don't miss another episode of the podcast by going to allthingsrisk.co.uk. That's .co.uk. We will be back very soon. Until then, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.